You are listening to the Riverfront Church Podcast, a place to explore faith, history, ideas, and more.
Hello, friends. I'm Pastor Edwin Estevez. I'm with my colleague,
Pastor Emma.
And we have a very special guest today, Amit Barak. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah, Amit Barak, that's right.
Amit Barak. And Barak, as I understand it, means blessing, to bless. Is that right?
That's bracha. Actually, Barak in Hebrew, it's after Barak, Barak and Dvorah from the Bible. But Barak is a shortcut of Berkovich, which is an Hungarian last name.
Cool.
Oh, interesting. So we've got all sorts of cultures mixing here. And Amit, what does that mean? Does that have...
Amit means a friend.
A friend. Okay, yeah. Well, here's an interesting fact. I once looked up what Edwin meant. Edwin is the derivative of Edward, and it means a fortunate friend.
Right.
Friend, some Anglo-Saxon past. Emma, I don't know if you've ever looked up what your name is. I'm imagining it's a derivative of like Emmanuel, maybe.
Mine is not an exciting translation. It means grandmother or ancestress. So it's fine. not that great.
Born is a very valuable thing. That's a good thing. So friends, welcome to the 505 podcast. This is the podcast of Riverfront Church. As you may have heard, I'm beginning to wind down my time with Riverfront Church. I do hope to stay connected in some ways and, of course, continue to listen to the podcast. But I'm really excited to welcome you if you're listening in today. We're going to be talking about several topics, one of which is what does it mean to be a Christian in Israel, to live in Israel? What does it mean to be an Arab living in Israel? And all sorts of related topics. And of course, we hope that this is informative to you. We hope that it's a blessing. So welcome once again to the Riverfront 505 podcast. So I'm really excited. This is sort of a sequel to the prior conversation with Seth. Seth was on the podcast and he introduced us to Amit. So Amit, tell us a little bit about yourself for our listeners today. Tell us a little bit about how you got to Israel and what keeps you busy.
Well, I was born in Israel, born and raised in Israel. I was born in Nazareth Elite. Nazareth Elite is the Jewish town next to Nazareth. Nazareth is the biggest Arab town in Israel. Used to be a majority of Christians. Now most of the population in Nazareth, 70% are Muslims, 30% are Christians. And Nazareth Elite and Nazareth are neighbor towns, a lot of shared economy and relations. And in this atmosphere, I grew up. I went to a Jewish school in Nazareth Elite. In the Jewish town, we only have Jewish schools. But I also had in the school students that came from Christian families, from Muslim families. And that's how I got to know Christians and Muslims. But I must say on a basic level. But that's developed, knowing them better and better, that's developed with the years and mostly in the last 8 years that I'm involved within the Christian community in a historical process, historical change inside the community of integrating more into the Israeli society. The Israeli society, of course, the majority of the society is Jewish. And when I say integration of Christian, I mean as a community, as a collective, not as individuals, because as individuals, Christians are integrated in Israel in all aspects.
Okay. Well, thanks. So growing up near a pretty famous place, Nazareth, what was it like? I mean, what you would read the stories about Jesus of Nazareth, and that sort of, did that give it some importance for Christians there, or what was that like in tourism?
Well, on that? Of course, for Christians, it is very important to live in Nazareth all around, even Christians that grew up or lived all their life in Israel, but decided to go a little bit outside the city. For the open space, they usually choosing to move to the villages around Nazareth or to Nazareth Elite, to some neighborhoods in Nazareth Elite, but to stay close to Nazareth, to stay close to the private schools of the churches, to stay close to the holy places, to the churches in Nazareth. I just want to clarify, I'm Jewish. I'm Jewish, but working with Christians in the last 8 years and grew up with the Christians, for me as a Jewish, to live next to Nazareth is to live next to very important and historical place. You always meet tourists from all over the world. So this is another thing that you get open your eyes to. You meet people from all around the world. For us as teenagers who grew up in Nazareth Elite, we used to go to Nazareth to sit in restaurants. And that's where we used to spend our free time mostly. We came from a small town, a Jewish town, with not many attractions. The attractions used to be in Nazareth. So the market, for example, and everything, we used to go travel in Nazareth. So that's how we got to learn about the city of Nazareth. And of course, I think Christians who live in Nazareth are very proud that they are from Nazareth.
I know Pastor Emma has a heart for people who aren't particularly Christian, who are seeking, you know, they're seeking answers, and so she studies a lot and kind of listens to people around their spirituality, around interfaith. Pastor Emma is now leading a church in Lower Brandywine Presbyterian Church, just across from a place called Winterthur in Delaware, which kind of has its own history. But I imagine there might be some similarities there with some of your work as a Jewish person working with Christians who are Arab in Israel. So how did that come about?
Well, as I said before, I grew up in Nazareth Elite and I got to know Christians, but I knew it on a basic level. 8 years ago in 2012, a group of Christians, Arabic speaking Christians from Nazareth. Some of them are officers in the IDF or in the police. They stood up after they saw what's going on with the Christians in Syria, in Iraq, in the Middle East. And they decided that it's about time that the Christians in Israel will take a step and will call the youth, the Christian youth in Israel, to volunteer to the IDF. Now, I want to explain. In Israel, we have a law. We are, when someone is 18 years old, he's obligated to serve in the IDF, in the army. IDF is Israel Defense Forces, by law. But this law is only for Jews, for Druze, the Druze community, and for Circassians, the Circassian community. Arabs, Muslims, and Christians, they are not obligated to serve by law, but they can volunteer. So in 2012, a group of Christian officers, they stood up together with the Greek Orthodox priest from Nazareth, Father Gabriel Nadav, and for the first time in the history of Israel and the history of the Christian community in Israel, they called in public for Christians in Israel to take a step and to send or to they called the youth to volunteer to the army in order to defend Israel because they said, look, what's happening to our brothers and sisters in the Middle East? We are living here in Israel. We have democracy. We have freedom of speech, freedom of religion. We are free. We have security. So we need to do something. We need to defend our home. Israel is also our home. That's our homeland. We need to defend it. So that was the first time the community, people from the community made this step. So, and I heard about it. And for me, it was very important to stand up with them and to help them, because it's a new process, and it's not easy for someone who grew up in an atmosphere, for a mother even, for a mother to send her children to the army, it's not something easy. But when you are growing up into that, in the Jewish families, in the Druze families, it's something that you are used to since Israel was established. So mothers, you know, they grew up with it. They served in the army. It's easier. But for a Christian mother to send her son to the army, this is something new. So it was very important for me to support and help them also to speak as a Jew, to speak on behalf of them to the Jewish majority in Israel. So in August 2008, Father Gabriel, together with those activists and the officers, they founded an organization. They called it Christian Israeli Christians Recruitment Forum, or also they we had another name, Christian Empowerment Council, and we began to call, to make some step to call the Christian youth to volunteer to the IDF. That was the first idea. And then it developed. But maybe before I will speak more about this process, I need to give you some introduction about the Christians in Israel.
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
So in Israel, the Christian, Arabic-speaking Christians are a very small minority within a minority. We have in Israel 20% of the populations are minorities. Around 1.3 million are Muslim Arabs. And then you have about 100,000 Druze. And then some other small communities, Circassians, Samaritans, et cetera, et cetera. And the Christians, the Arabic speaking Christians, they are about 180,000. Which is only actually 2% of the Israeli population.
Now, Amit, let me pause you right there just to clarify something for our listeners. Being a minority in Israel, does that mean not being Jewish? Or does it, like in America, does that include color? Does that include color of skin? Does that include any other ethnicities? You see what I'm saying? Is it just around Jewishness? Or being, you know, from multi-generations of Israel? Or what does that look like?
A minority in Israel is non-Jewish.
Okay.
Very simple.
Okay.
Because really 80% of the, around 80% of the population in Israel are Jews, and then you have the others, the minorities, Muslims, Christians, Druze, Circassians, the Bedouins, Samaritans, and a few other smaller groups.
One more follow-up. So does that mean if I were a Russian Jew and I moved to Israel, I would be considered part of the majority in Israel?
Yes.
Okay.
Part
Great.
Of the majority. You will have your own media. You will have your own culture, you know, you will keep your culture, your Russian culture, but you will be part of the majority.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And one last one to throw out there. If I were an Ethiopian Jew, would I also be a part of the majority? So I keep my culture, but I'm still part of the majority.
Same as Russians, yes.
Okay.
And same as other Jewish group, part of the majority, with your own culture. You know, you have your synagogue. If you want, you can go. You can continue pray like how you used to from, and with the food and the songs, your culture where you came from, but you are part of the majority.
So Israel is, in that sense, is very different from the United States around issues of color. So it's not so much color-based, it's religion-based is yes. What we're looking at. Okay.
Exactly. Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. That's what I'm here for. Just ask me anything you want to know. So Most of the Arabic-speaking Christians are living in the north of Israel, in the Galilee and around the Haifa. And they are living in most of them in Arabic villages or town with majority of Muslims. Others are living in Jewish towns or mixed towns. And actually there are only two Christian villages in Israel that 90% of the populations are Christians. The big cities where Christians living are Nazareth, as I said, Haifa, which is in the north, Jerusalem, and Shfaram. It's a town not far from Haifa, between Nazareth and Haifa. The population are increasing every year. The Christian population in Israel are increasing every year. The Christians in Israel, they are considered to be the most educated group in Israel. And this is thanks to a private school system of the churches. Most of the schools are Catholics, and then you have some Protestants and some Orthodox. But those private schools brings the Christian youth to very good results in all exams and very good starting points in the academy. And this private school system is the source of the honor, the pride of the Christian community. They're really proud of this education system, and we can understand the why.
So can I ask a question about that? And this is probably something that I should know. The alternative to these private Christian schools for everyone else is what? Is it public schooling? Is it Jewish schooling? What does it look like if you're not attending one of those schools?
Private school. Private schools. You have private schools in the Arab sectors that they are under the Arab division in the Ministry of Education. But those who want to study in the Jewish public schools, they can do that if they want, if they live next to a Jewish town. That's also a possibility. And in the private schools of the churches, the studies are in Arabic, of course, or the mother language, Arabic, and then they study also other languages. Also depends which church exactly the school belongs to, but because the schools are private, many Muslims send their kids also to study in those schools, if they can afford, those who can afford the studies, because they are very expensive, because it's a private system. If I speak about denomination, religious denominations in Israel, we can divide them into three historical groups. This is by a thesis of a friend of mine, actually, Dr. Francis Daniel, a Catholic from Nazareth. And he divided the Christian in Israel into three groups: the ancient Christians, which are descendants of the first followers of Jesus. They lived in the land of Israel before Christianity became the official religion of the Byzantine Empire in the fourth century. No one can now prove that he is a descendant of any Jewish who was a follower of Jesus, but that's how it all began. And then they are a descendants of native peoples and tribes who adopted Christianity before it was the religion of the Byzantine Empire, and then after. And communities that lived in the area before the Arabs came here in the 7th century. So as I said, descendants of Jews, that's the earliest. And then the main groups actually are descendants of Aramean tribes, Syriac tribes, who used to live here in the land of Israel and north of the Lebanon Israel. Descendants of Samaritans, of Greek, of Phoenicians, of Nabataeans, who used to live in the south of Israel. The Nabataean tribes, the Arab tribes, they convert to Christianity under the Byzantine Empire. Now the Greek Orthodox Church today is continuing the church, the Byzantine Church, and they are representing, we can say, the ancient Christians, but the Greek Orthodox Church runs by Greek clergymen. In the churches, in towns, in villages, the priests are local, are Arabic speaking. But in the patriarchs in Jerusalem, it's the bishops, the archbishops, and the patriarchs, they are only Greeks and not from the local community. Then we have the second group, the Christians of the Middle Ages, mainly Catholics. And that's began after the Crusaders who came here, and many local Christians who were from the Eastern churches converted or moved to the Catholic Church. Later in the 18th century, a group of Greek Orthodox Christians split out from the Greek Orthodox Church, and they founded the Melkite Church, the Greek Catholic Church. So the main church that represent the Christians, these Christians today, the Middle Ages Christian, is the Melkite Church, the Greek Catholic Church. We have the Roman Catholic Church also in Israel, but they are very small within the Christian community. The Greek Catholic Church, the leaders of the Greek Catholic Church are locals, are Arabic speaking Christians.
I wanted to pause there a second just to ask. So often when people look at the history of Islam in the Middle East, they see that as, you know, the jihad, right? The jihadist movement and spreading around in the area. And that sort of, there's a legacy around that of like, oh, it was kind of born out of this conquest and violence. Is there a similar perspective around Christians descending from the Crusaders, so to speak, that are legacies of the Crusades? Is there a sense in which, well, they were here, they're sort of born out of violence and conquest as well? What's the perception there? Because it's interesting that you named them as the Middle Age Christians, and so there was a connection there to the Crusades.
So when the Crusades came here, they put a lot of pressure on the local Christian community. They acted in violence against the Jews and Muslims, but also against the Eastern Christians here. So many of the Eastern Christians, they left the local church and they adopted the Catholic Church that the Crusaders brought. And for example, in Jerusalem, there's one area in the old city of Jerusalem that used to be the marketplace that was run by the local Eastern Christians. When the Crusader came, they built a new market in other region of the old city of Jerusalem because they want to earn the money and they want to witness the market of the local Eastern Christians. So that's how it develops. And then we have the third group, the new Christians in the modern period. That's the Armenians Christians who immigrated to the Holy Land, and the Protestant Church. The different streams in the Protestant Church that began only in the 19th century when the Ottoman Empire gave the permissions to the European countries to build churches here. So we can see the Anglican and the Russians and the Lutheran, et cetera, et cetera. And but there are only 10% of the local Christian population. So the Greek Catholics is the biggest church, 15 to 16% of the Christians in Israel. Then you have the Greek Orthodox, 30 to 40%, and then the Protestants and also some other small churches like the Coptics. The Roman Catholics, as I mentioned, they are small. The Maronites, the Syriac, and all the other Protestant churches. So that's how the Christian built.
To summarize for our listeners, so basically you have the Christians who symbolically, in a sense, because it's hard genetically, tie themselves to the original Jewish followers of Jesus. Then you have the Middle Ages Christians who are sort of legacy of the Crusades, and then you have the sort of modern framework of Christians that include Arminians, include Protestants, and some other small groups there as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Pastor Emma, sorry, you had a question.
Sorry, I was going to take us on a little bit of a different train of thought. I'm wondering. The terms Arab Christians and Arabic speaking Christians, how do they play into this whole picture that you gave us and into the work that you're doing?
Okay. So I'm getting back to the process that began in the summer 2012, volunteering to the IDF and integration into the Israel society. So I want to mention again, when I say integration, I refer to integration of the community of representative of the community and integration into the Israeli society to build the state of Israel, to strengthen the Israeli society with partnership together with the Jewish majority and with other groups such as the Druze and the Circassians, which are already part. And but because individually Christians are integrated, we have judges in the Supreme Court, we have members of Knesset, that's the Israeli parliament. You can find Christians, directors of hospital, Christians, scholars in the academy, in sport, in culture, and everywhere. You have very famous Christians, but they did it as an individual career, not as some symbolic step now that call that they speak on behalf of the community and on behalf of the state of Israel. The process that began in 2012, that was integrating into the society and adopting a Israeli identity. And that brings me to what you asked. Most of the Christians in Israel, also around in the Middle East, most of them, not all, but most will identify themselves as Christian Arabs, because that's how the historical, that's development of the historical process. We hear for the first time the term Christian Arab after the Muslims conquest the area, and they pulled out the Aramaic language that was the spoken language by Jews and by Christians in the land of Israel and in the region. They pulled out the Aramean and the other tribes' culture, and slowly, slowly, the Christians here adopted the Arabic, and with the language also, they adopted the Arab culture. They kept Christianity, but they adopted the cultures, and that's And that point in the 7th, 8th century, we hear for the first time the term Arab, Christian Arab. And that's how they live since then, as Arabs, with Arabic as a mother language, with Arab culture. And that's how most of them will identify themselves. But you can still find islands in the Middle East that kept Aramaic and kept their identity. You have the Syriac who kept the Aramean identity. You have the Assyrians in Iraq, the Chaldeans. They never identified themselves as Arabs. Here in Israel, it was a little bit different. They didn't keep, except the Maronites, some of the Maronites and some of the Syriac Arameans. The others didn't keep the language, the Aramaic and the prayers in Aramaic, and they adopted the Arabic in all aspects. So one thing of this historical change that began in 2012 was also to explore the historical roots. Those groups of Christians who stood up and at the beginning they called to volunteer the IDF, then they said, if we actually want the Christians to take this step and to really understand that Israel is our homeland, not only because we were born here and not only because we live and prosper here, but because we are really connected to here, we should know who we are. And they began to explore and to study. And some of them, together with Father Gabriel Nadav, they leaded a process of learning this issue and bring it to the Ministry of Interior. And in 2014, September 2014, the Minister of Interior in Israel decided to recognize the Aramean identity as one of the nationalities in the Israeli Nationality Registry in the Ministry of Interior. So that was something very symbolic for the Christians here. Now, if you are a Christian, you can choose if you want to be written under a Christian Arab or under a Aramean. But not all of the Christians accept it. I'm not speaking about the technical move of going to the ministry. It's a long process of bureaucracy. You have to appeal to court and everything. But people really, many of them didn't understand what it is. If you will meet a Christian here, it's not surprising, but if you will ask him, what are you, who are you, how you identify yourself, you will get different answers. I will give you a story. Once I got into a store in the old city of Jerusalem in the Christian quarter. The man in the store was very proud. He showed me a picture of President Trump holding some ancient pottery. And he told me, this is from my store. This gift that President Trump received in the Western Wall, it's from here, from this store. And then I was curious. I asked him, so what is your background? What are you? He told me, I'm nothing. Mm-hmm. I told him, okay, you have a store here in the Christian quarter. Your mm-hmm. parents. He told me, I'm an atheist. I'm nothing. So I asked him, so who your parents are? Where are they came from? What's your source, your roots? He told me, my father is a communist. He came from a communist family, and my mother is Christian. And then I asked him, but your communist father and his communist family, originally they were Christians, aren't they? And he told me, yes, of course. So when you ask Christians here to tell about himself, to define his identity, it depends on many identities. It's a result of, again, it's the result of the development of the historical process. Many of them will say, first of all, the basic things, they will say we are Christians, but then they will say we are Christian Arabs, or they will say we are Christians Israeli Arabs, or we are Christians Aramean Israeli, or we are Christians Arab Palestinian, or they will say we are communists. Depends on really how do they feel connected more to. And the Christians that I'm working with in the last 8 years, they identify themselves, most of them, again, some still identify themselves as Christian Arabs. Many identify themselves as Arameans, or if they are coming from the Coptic church, so they are Coptic or Syriac, but that's the church they are coming from. And the others, which are not yet, it's not yet clear for them. They didn't study yet the roots or the in between. They prefer to say we are Arabic speaking Christians. So that covers more or less everything. That's how we prefer, I prefer, and my Christian friends, we prefer to say Arabic speaking Christians. So that's, we are okay with those who say we are Christians Arabs. We are okay with those who say we are Aramean Christians. They are Armenian Christians, but their mother language is still Arabic. So that's how we prefer to say. But again, it's a process. It's a process that Christians here are getting back to learn about their historical roots before the Arab Muslims conquest.
It's really interesting to me to think about that idea of kind of reclaiming identity and really digging into roots. The area I grew up in, you know, North Carolina, in the US, and it was very important to know not only who you were, but where you came from, like really deep and far back. So it's interesting that part of the work that y'all do is to help people to realize that story and to really dig into it and embrace it. And I love that that's kind of a common thread that we share, is that interest of knowing and claiming who you are. So anyway, I just thought that was kind of a neat connection.
This is something that really catch me as a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, as a Zionist Jew, and we were lucky that our ancestors for generations kept the identity.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see Christians here who is trying, who wants to study about his roots, it's very important for me. I think it's very important that people will know where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very much connected to this idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to hear a little bit of Pastor Emma's identity when she said y'all, which is a very southern regional word, which I'm sure you've heard before, meaning you all, y'all. Mm-hmm. So you got to hear a little bit of that. Yeah, and it's interesting. It seems worldwide, there's this spirit of the age, right? There's this, what do the Germans call it? The Geist, the Geist of
Geistzeit.
The age.
Mm.
Yeah, that's Geistzeit. Right. And it seems worldwide that there's this seeking that people and countries are doing. They're sort of almost soul seeking. They're trying to figure out their roots, who they are, where they're from, where they're going. Part of me wonders if that's because of the quick change around technology, how quickly you can feel non-grounded, what you knew yesterday so different from today and then tomorrow very quickly. That's one thing. I think secondly, we've always had globalization. And in fact, Israel is a perfect example of that. I mean, Israel has really always been in many ways a global state. And before that, a global nation and, you know, all these different things just because of trade routes and all of the cultures there. But we are global on a whole other level now. You know, we can speak via Zoom to someone in Israel and Detroit, Michigan, and Wilmington, Delaware. But from the South, and my family's from Guatemala. And I mean, you know, the globalization, the ability to travel and connect via technology is incredible. I think the third thing I actually think it's around wealth. So I think the wealthier people become, the more they have time to reflect, right? So you're not just in survival mode, but also you begin to ask the questions like, because you are reflecting, what is this for? You know, what are we doing? And I feel that we have so much stuff, especially industrialized nations that are doing very well. And I'll put that in quotes, very well for some, not for all, obviously. But those countries are really having narrative issues of who are we? And narrative issues have to do with cohesion, right? Social cohesion. How do we tell the story of who we are and why we do what we do? And there's something interesting there because I think there's a connection between the United States and Israel on that question, something that in the United States has been called American exceptionalism. Is there something similar? Is there an Israeli exceptionalism? Can you speak to that similarity if there is any that you find?
If I understood correctly, maybe in Israel, you have two levels for that. First of all, the basics is to believe in the Zionist idea. You don't have to be a Zionist, maybe, but you have to believe that without Zionism, Israel will not survive, or Israel would never be established. And Zionism is developed, of course, naturally developed of the 19th and 20th century from Judaism. And you can find in Israel many Zionists which are not Jewish as well. So this is something that is very common. If you accept Israel as a Jewish democratic state who give freedom to the minorities, this is the first base. This is something that you need to accept, and this is something that is common to us all here in Israel. The second thing is the entrance ticket to the Israeli society. If you really want to feel part of the Israeli society, you need to make the step and to serve the IDF or to do a national civil service. This is a main key in being part of the Israeli society, also for Jews and also for minorities. If you want to feel part, you need to do this kind of military service or civil society, national service. And that's how first you get to know other people. If you studied in a religious school, a Jewish religious school, or Christian school, or public Arab schools, when you volunteer or when you recruit to the IDF, you get to know other people from other backgrounds that came with the other identities, and this is what connects us. Now, you asked before about the Russian Jews and the Ethiopian Jews, and you can ask about the Yemeni Jews and the Moroccan Jews and the Ashkenazi Jews, and from all over. We have a very diverse society in Israel, as you mentioned, and it's very special. And I think that people are exploring their roots. In Israel, you can go to different synagogues and you can hear the same prayers, but in different songs. But this is disappearing because the young generations, you know, people are not now, they're getting married with everyone, is getting married with everyone in the Jewish society, also in the Christian community. Catholic used to marry Catholic, Greeks Orthodox used to get married with Greek Orthodox, but now everything is mixing. So in Israel now, there is a process of recording and preserving prayers and different aspects in cultures of small groups of different Jewish groups of Yemenites, Yemenites and Ethiopians, and because it will disappear one day. We are mixing and it will disappear. And so now we are trying to preserve everything. You already, if you're walking in Jerusalem, you can see different synagogues, but some of them are already getting closed because the young generation moved on. They got married with others, Yemenite with Ashkenazic, and it's not an issue anymore. So, and the elders are passing. And so people are doing steps also to explore, to record the songs, to record the prayers. And I think this is very important. And the Christians here are also doing the same things. But that's again, what the wake up call was, what happened, still happening to Christians in the Middle East. That was the wake up call for the Christians here in Israel.
And I want to get to that in just a moment, but one more question, just again, relating to American exceptionalism, which kind of views the United States as a special country in the world that has a special task. And in fact, the United States has often used imagery related to Israel, right? So it'll say, you know, the description of the United States as a promised land. You know, the that's both true for Mormons, very, very literally, but also for Black Christians. So Black Christians who were fighting for the civil rights were saying, we've got to get to the promised land, that's freedom in the United States. That's one area. Somebody like President Ronald Reagan used imagery that Jesus was using. You know, the city on the shining hill, obviously, is a play on that scripture. That's not an exact quote, but it is taken from the Torah of the Jews being a light for all nations. And so that's sort of the American exceptionalism. A part of that American exceptionalism is the melting pot. And I'm sure you may have heard of that expression before. There are all these cultures and races and languages that have come together and formed the United States. And I'm hearing a lot of that ethnicity as well and all of that diversity in Israel. Is there a way in which Israel views itself as a melting pot, and does it see itself as having a special role in the world?
Israel definitely see itself here, the Israeli society, as a melting pot, but melting pot to the Jewish majority, inside the Jewish majority, again, with Jews that came from all over the world, and now they are getting, it's not now, it's for already for many, many years, actually since Israel was established, that they are mixed marriage as a melting pot. And it's also melting pot with the minorities, not with the marriage, but with sharing ideas. And but this process is still developing. Now in Israel, in the last 2 years, there are many, many private schools and many private teachers who teach Arabic. It's became a big thing here in the Jewish, among Jews to study Arabic. We study at school, but we study in a very low level. We didn't take it too seriously. But now in the last 2 years, many people in Israel, many Jews in Israel are studying Arabic. And in the Christian community, as I said before, again, there are a marriage between the different denominations for many years, it used to be merged inside the dominations, and Christians are getting to know their roots and their connection to the land of Israel, and their connections to the Bible, to the Old Testament, the connections to the Jewish people. This is also some of the process, and the Muslims here. The process is slower, but we also can see change, and we can see more and more Arabs, more activists and teachers, and some prominent Arab leaders in the Arab sectors that are pulling the Arab, the Muslims, to get to know more the Jewish majority, and to make more contacts, more connections. We see that, but it's definitely a melting pot. Yes, I didn't say it before. Thanks you for reminding me the term melting pot, but the Israeli society is a melting pot.
So I'm wondering, knowing that there's all these different cultures coming together, and knowing that a lot of the work that you do kind of in your mission statement, you talk about the full integrations of Christians into the country. What sort of practical or hopeful things are happening because of this work, or that you hope will happen in the future? You know, you've talked about military service, but I'm wondering, are there other ways that it's playing out in society?
Yes, of course. When the first organization that we established that used to run for 5 years until the Father Gabriel closed it in 2017 and went back to the church. So except encouraging the youth to volunteer to the IDF and National Service, we did many activists within education. We gave Hebrew classes. We took the youth to trips around Israel. We took them to meet with different groups of Jewish teenagers. We helped in employment placement. We gave scholarships to Christians who volunteered to the IDF or National Service and went to university. We did many, many steps, not only regarding the IDF service, but mostly with education and with also helping Christians in every step we could help them to get into the Israeli society, again, as representative of the collective, not only as individuals. And today, since 2018, together with a friend of mine, Elias Zarina, he's a Arabic-speaking Christian, a Greek Orthodox that was born in the Christian quarter of Jerusalem, we established an organization, Jerusalemites Initiative, and we are trying to bring this historical process that began in the Galilee to bring it to the Christians in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, there are 13,000 Christians, a small community, very diverse. Every church, every denomination in Israel has a church in Jerusalem, and the patriarchs here, the bishops, they are all sitting here in Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, it's a challenge. It's much harder than Christians in other places in Israel, because in Jerusalem, most of the Christians are living in the old city and in the Arab neighbors around the whole city, and what we also call Eastern Jerusalem. And Eastern Jerusalem was under Jordan until 1967. And from 1967, after the Six Days War, when Jerusalem was occupied by Israel. We returned Jerusalem back to us after we lost it in 1948. The Christians and also the Arab Muslims, they became residents of Israel. They are not citizens, they are residents. They can apply and ask for citizenship. Some do, some still don't want. So this is the first barrier, because not all of them hold Israeli citizenships. If you are a resident, you can vote for the, you get everything. You get social insurance and all the rights. You can vote to the municipality, but you cannot vote to the parliament. That's the only thing you cannot get, and you cannot receive a passport. So this is the first barrier. But then you have the Jerusalem is a very spiritual, but also very political. All the pressure is here. Christians that live in the Arab neighborhood, they have pressure from the neighbors. Palestinian identity is much stronger in Jerusalem. Every family of Christians in Jerusalem, they have relatives in Bethlehem or in Ramallah, which are under the Palestinian Authority. They don't want to risk their families. So in Jerusalem, the process is very slow, still underground. And we mostly deal with education here. We also give Hebrew classes here to Christians. We are supplying food for needs within the Christian community. And we are doing trips. And we are helping also in job placement and everything we can. We want to bring them the opportunity to get to know the Israeli society, and they will make their decision. How do they want to live? How do they want to identify? We just, in Jerusalem, we want to give them the opportunity to know the Israeli society, to know what they can achieve there. Many of the Christians, the Arabic speaking Christians in Jerusalem, many of them do not speak Hebrew at all. They don't learn Hebrew at schools, or if they learn, it's in a very low level. The private schools of the churches in Jerusalem teach them, of course, different languages. Again, depends of the church that owns the schools. But Hebrew, it's in a very low level. Again, it's all politics. It's all politics and the educational system in Jerusalem, the private, but also the public educational system that is under the Israeli Ministry of Education, the materials and how they teach, it used to be by the Jordanians, and now it's under the Palestinian Authority. They teach like they teach in the schools in Ramallah or in Bethlehem. The schools are under the Israeli education ministry, but they teach them in the same materials and the same way they teach them in the Palestinian Authority. So in this way, they don't learn Hebrew, and in this way, they don't learn anything positive about Israel. We want to teach them and also the other side and to give them the opportunity to choose. So that's what we do with the Christians in Jerusalem. Slow process, it's a long run, a long marathon. We are all volunteers. The organization is fully voluntarily. Christians and Jews that taking a part of it. And step by step, we believe we are on the right way. We believe we have common values. And we believe some will choose to get closer And I believe they will also benefit from it in the futures because they were born here, they live here. That's the labor market. So the first step is to learn Hebrew, the spoken language of the states, and that's how they can develop.
Thank you, Amit. And I see that we're at about an hour. That I hope we can continue, hope we can have a follow-up. But as we begin to wrap up, I do have one more question for you, for me, which is, what inspires you to do this work? Is this, do you feel like this is a call out of your faith? Is this just a shared humanity? Is this just hope for a better Israel? What inspires you to do this work?
It's called out of my faith and my Zionist perspective. Zionism is a national democratic movement. We believe, and also Theodor Herzl, that he the biggest Zionist, when he wrote his books, Alt Neuland, he also wrote about the minorities that will be part in the state of Israel. And I really believe they should be part. And of course, if they want to be partners and to build with us together and not criticize all the time or not sitting on the fence like it used to be. I'm here to help them. I will help them and I will also speak on behalf of them to the Jewish majorities. Because this is what I believe we are living here in this land, the land of Israel, the Holy Land. We were born here and we have to build it together. Israel is not perfect also, but we need to fix together in partnership.
So I'm wondering, a lot of the work that you're doing, some of our listeners might feel really disconnected from because we can't do a lot of traveling right now. As much as we might want to, it's probably not the best idea. What sort of, are there things that you would recommend, especially our American hearers, to resources to look into, things so that they could learn more to be better educated about both your work and kind of the situation in general? What kind of advice do you have for them or calls to hope or to action or anything like that?
To listen to the voices that usually don't come to the stage, to the front. This is the first thing. And the second thing is to follow the Bible. Mm-hmm. When I speak to Christians here, when I speak to Christians abroad, we all know the places, we all know the sites that we read about, we pray. And it's actually here, the sites are here. Mm-hmm. So try to visit when the sky will open again. That's where everything happened. That's where everything began. This is the cradle of Judaism, cradle of Christianity. That's here in the land of Israel. And this is something that is common for us.
I love that. Like, oh, I wish I could just stand up on Sunday morning and preach that as my sermon and, you know, that's it. But I love that's the message and the words that you want to share with us. Is there anything else that you would want to make sure that our hearers know or anything that you want to point out or to pay attention to?
In the future, when you will visit Israel, try to meet with people, not only visiting the site, but also to meet with people, with different people from different groups, different minorities. There are a lot of stories, a lot of interesting stories. If you visit the Samaritans, you can hear the special story, the special legacy of the Samaritans in Israel, a small community of 800 people, that's all. Mm-hmm. But there exist the Samaritans that you read about in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. They still exist. They are living here in Israel. And meet the local Christians and meet the Druze. and the Arab Muslims and explore the Israeli society with all the politics, with all the tension, with everything, we are building something. And things are changing all the time, all the time. Sometimes you go 2 steps forward, 1 step backwards, but things are really getting better.
Awesome. Pastor Edwin, did you have anything else that you wanted to add in?
I just want to thank you for your time today. I'm really grateful. I know we're in different time zones, but I really appreciate you helping to clarify not only Christians there in Israel, the Christian cultures and history, but also your work from the Zionist perspective and some similarities there with the United States. There's so many things that come up. There's so many different pathways we can take with these conversations. So I hope this is not the last. And so I hope we can follow up. But thank you once again for your time. This has been a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. And in Hebrew, we say, Leshana Abba Yerushalayim. Next year in Jerusalem.
Sounds great. We would love to.
Thank you. Well, friends who've been listening to us, we hope that this has been a blessing to you, that you've learned a little bit more. We want to keep our friend Amit Barak in prayer, keep his work with Arabic-speaking Christians in prayer, keep Israel in prayer. And I know a lot of the challenges there with the challenges and the opportunities and the hope around a more cohesive society, a more peaceful society. And of course, please keep our world in prayer as we continue to struggle with the pandemic and how to work together as a world created by God. So, friend, thank you for joining the Riverfront Church 505 podcast. My thanks again to Amit Barak. My thanks to my colleague, Pastor Emma, and the man behind the cam, Ken Grant. Please join us next time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Riverfront Church podcast. You can connect with us online at riverfrontwilmo.com or on Facebook. Just search for Riverfront Church in Wilmington, Delaware. May God meet you where you are and lead you where you are meant to go.